This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about the Ohio State University's Center for Aviation Studies. Also, a student pilot killed under mysterious circumstances, new wings for F-15 C&Ds, new airline regulations, Bombardier layoffs, seat assignments by passenger size, hot props, airshow and air race reports, and a paint job that fails as a conspiracy theory. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 424 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is first Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. So great to be here. Looking forward to doing a show again. I know I've missed a couple, and I spent all the time on the airplane catching up on our past episodes. And I got to say, we really produce an awful lot of great content.
You like that, huh? It was good.
Even topics that I wasn't expecting to be really good shows ended up being really good shows. So,
okay,
including the one about our listener survey.
We'll come back to that. But first, let's introduce our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, Max. Hey, Brian, and everybody else out there in listener land. Good to do a show. We're sorry about last week, but things happen.
They do sometimes. But also with us is the other Max, Max West. Max Trescott, a certified flight instructor and author, glass cockpit expert.
Gentlemen, nice to be back here with you. I was gone for 2 weeks. Last week I was traveling on vacation, and I want to say hello, New England. I was out in Boston visiting my daughter and son-in-law, and we spent some time up in Vermont looking at the leaves, and oh my gosh, it was just fun being back on the East Coast. I, too, listen to lots and lots and lots of podcasts, including some of ours. So yeah, it's been good, and it's great to be back.
Well, we almost have a full complement, except that Rob Mark, who was planning to be here, let us know just a few minutes ago that he's sort of stuck at the airport. Rather, they're working on some kind of a video shoot, and they're running late, so Rob doesn't think he's going to be able to make it, unfortunately. But our guest is here. Our guest this episode is Martin Rotler. He's a lecturer and the industry relations coordinator for the Ohio State University's Center for Aviation Studies in Columbus, Ohio. Martin, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, Airplane Geeks, here in the podcast and everywhere else. It's good to be here, and I'm hoping to keep up the curmudgeonly old man status in Rob's absence.
It's not happening.
We might make him a permanent co-host. I like this.
That's right, if that works out. Yes, yes. we would like to mention last episode. As most of you, I think, know now, it was kind of almost a non-episode. I was sick. Thank you to several listeners wrote in and gave me some good wishes, helped me get my mind straight for getting well and getting back to the show. Also, we announced that our listener survey is open. We last did a listener survey in 2014. We got some really, really great information and learned a lot about you all and what you like and, well, what isn't so much value to you. And that was extremely helpful. So we've got it's a very simple survey. It won't take very long at all, perhaps 5 minutes. If you haven't taken the survey yet, you can find that at airplanegeeks.com/survey. And if you have completed the survey, thanks a lot. I checked this morning and we had 150 responses so far. So that's a good start. We want all of you to give us your feedback through that survey.
Yeah, keep them coming.
All right. Well, with that, why don't we get started with the aviation news? Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Ready. Our first item comes from NBC Connecticut. This is student pilot killed in East Hartford crash, died of smoke inhalation and thermal injuries. This is actually from a couple of weeks ago, I guess by now. But what we have here is a student pilot, Ferris Freitek. He's a Jordanian, or was a Jordanian national. He was killed and his instructor was injured when their twin engine Piper PA-34 crashed on Main Street in East Hartford. Now, as I looked at the photos in the press, I saw some landmarks I recognized, and that's all, literally right across the street, about, well, I'd say maybe 200 yards from the office I worked in once, and very close to the Pratt & Whitney main admin building. The investigation is still underway. It appears that there was some kind of possibly an altercation, something between the student and the pilot that resulted in this crash. The instructor, Drone Mama, tells me just a few minutes ago that he was released today from the hospital. But again, we don't have a lot of information about that. But that's pretty bizarre. Max T, you're a flight instructor. Do you run across altercations or serious arguments or problems of that kind of magnitude with students?
Well, not anymore. I just retired. I quit. I read this story and said, I am out of here. You know, the thing that really struck me about this, I read when I arrived in Boston, this was the lead story on the local news, because this had just happened, in the adjacent state the night before. The thing that really struck me was people who so the flight instructor survived and they were able to interview him to some extent. And apparently what he and perhaps others related was that, yes, there was an argument between the CFI and the student pilot, but it was before they took off. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, why the heck would you go fly with somebody if, you know, there was anger and, emotion and, all kinds of problems beforehand? I mean, to me, that was potentially the big mistake. Now, we don't know how heated it was or, what the deal was. But, I have seen people who are, somewhat distracted or distraught, and they don't fly as well. And I think it makes a lot of sense from a risk management standpoint that when you see trouble signs that you kind of go, okay, maybe there's going to be some lost income today because I'm not going to fly with this person. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go up with someone who's, slightly crazy or emotional or angry. We were talking before the show. I had one person in my flying career who had a very large anger problem. And I remember one night sitting up there just thinking, wow, if this person decides to kill us now, there's not much I can do about it other than, a few strategies that I'm not going to name here right now so that the word doesn't get out as to what I'll do. But I wouldn't be, beyond loosening their seatbelt and opening their door. I'll put it that way.
Martin, can you identify with this? Have you run across, in your experience, the need to sort of evaluate if a student pilot is kind of got the right headset to go flying?
I don't have as much experience in the airplane as Max and probably Rob would have, but I've dealt with a number of students that have had signs of mental distress or have gone through significant personal life issues. And, it's one of those things where you have to tread with tread very, very lightly on dealing with it, because you don't want to potentially aggravate an issue. And you also want to make sure that you get the student the help that they need. And when you're in an enclosed environment with a student, particularly an airplane where you're one-on-one, it can be very hard to diffuse a situation like that. So, without actually being in the airplane, however, we can't, put thoughts into the student's head. We can't put thoughts or words into the instructor's head or actions. But, there are some ways that we have to kind of de-escalate the situation beyond just turning the airplane around or letting it happen. And that's something that comes with experience and skill, and something that can't necessarily be taught even.
Brian, were you going to say something?
When I first heard the story, it made me go back to think when I was teaching scuba, and not only me having to cancel a lesson one day, but also I think one of the things that I really try to impart on my students is just the decision-making over if something's not right, just don't go diving that day. And it's okay for the student to cancel a class. And I think it's okay for an instructor to cancel a class as well. But it's that self-awareness that you have in the situation where, again, in my opinion, it's okay to cancel it. Do it again another day when the conditions are right, either mental or physical or emotional. Just take care of yourself and do it again on a different day.
Well, I tell folks that you really want to watch out for those kind of five or six major, you know, life events that people talk about, death in the family, changing job, divorce, you know, those kinds of things. Interestingly, I had a flight just last night with, you know, someone who's really an excellent, excellent pilot, and he did fine in the air. And when we were doing the landings, it was night, granted, the landings were just not up to his, what I consider usual, you know, good job. And it was only afterwards I realized that sometime during the flight, he had mentioned to me that he's just in the process of putting a bid in on a house, and he thinks there may be a bidding war. He also has a child on the way. And I thought, wow, you know, there's a lot going on in his life. So, you know, these things do affect people.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the next item. This is from AOPA. AOPA asks Supreme Court to hear aircraft liability case. And this relates to an airplane crash in 2005. There was an engine failure and the pilot was killed. His spouse sued the engine manufacturer, claiming a design defect. I think this was in the carburetor. A U.S. district court found in 2014 that there was no design defect in the carburetor because the engine was certified and approved by the FAA. Well, now we have earlier this year, April in 2016, a U.S. Court of Appeals reversed that decision, and they ruled really two things. One was that FAA certification of the engine did not mean there was no design defect. Also, that the FAA does not preempt state law standards of care as far as aviation liability goes, or aviation products liability. That would mean that, as the AOP points out, that juries can hold a manufacturer to state design standards, even if all FAA requirements were met. What do you guys think? I mean, should FAA trump state requirements?
Yes. Can you imagine aircraft manufacturers have to worry about 50 different sets of design standards? That's nuts.
There's a quote in here from the general counsel of AOPA, Ken Mead. He points out and says that if a product is defective, aggrieved parties should receive compensation for injuries resulting from the defect, but standards set by the FAA, not by juries or the states themselves, should be used to determine whether the manufacturer is liable in aviation products liability cases. To do otherwise conflicts with the FAA's areas of responsibility and threatens the affordability and safety of general aviation. So, yeah, I think this is a big issue. AOPA has written a friend of the court brief, and that's been submitted to the Supreme Court. Gamma also has said that they, too, plan to file an amicus brief in this case. So this will be something to follow. Moving on to a military item. This is from combataircraft.net. U.S. Air Force looks to push F-15 C&Ds out to 2045. Wow. How do you extend the service life of F-15 C&Ds to 2045? Well, with the F-15 CD wing replacement program. David, what's this all about?
Our 1970s and 80s vintage F-15s are not quickly being replaced by things like F-22s and F-35s. And luckily, right now, the F-15 is still in production. So the Air Force has decided to take advantage of what's coming off the line right now, which is a revised wing that is being used for the SA, which is an F-15 SA, which is designed for Saudi Arabia. And it's a strengthened wing. It can carry more hard. It gets two more hard points. And they're looking to re-wing the existing fleet. So therefore, we can keep them flying to 2045. At that point, they'll be using F-15s to ferry F-22 pilots back, like they used to say about B-52s. It is kind of an amazing feat that we're going to be flying aircraft that will be over 65, 75 years old if they're flying to 45.
And I was thinking about that, 2045, that's a long ways off from now. It's what, about 30 years? The kids flying those airplanes have not been born yet today.
Oh. Exactly. You know, and there will be things like we have with the B-52s where at the B-52 level now, we've gotten fathers, sons, and granddaughters flying B-52s.
Wow.
So you can imagine we'll be dealing the same thing with the F-15s. It will be improving the aircraft substantially because the new wing that is going on the F-15s for the new build F-15s is a much better wing, and the additional hard points where you get the additional 1 and 9 stations, which have always been available, but not really. I mean, if you look at books from the 70s, F-15 show those extra pylons on the outer of the wing, but they never were implemented. In this case, it's going to be a standard feature. So you're getting, and you're also going to get things like where we have racks where currently the pylons have usually two rails for AIM-120s and AIM-9Xs. Well, they're going to come up with rails that could carry 8 AIM-120s on top of. You're talking about improving the brand on top of just preventing it from deteriorating. And it really is kind of sad that we're planning on flying airplanes to 2045 that really should have been replaced years ago.
David, when I first read this article, I was thinking that they were just modifying the hard points for the weapons, but this is an actual, the entire wings getting replaced on these aircraft, right?
It's not the first time. C-5s, 141s, C-130s. Rewinging is usually a normal procedure. You know, A-6s were planned on having rewings. It's the part that deteriorates the most and the quickest. So rewinging has always been an option on a lot of aircraft.
And that's easier and less expensive to do than to re-engine an aircraft, I'm assuming.
Exactly. Rewinging is one thing, but this is really an upgrade to the aircraft to make it. Adding a new wing is one thing, but adding the additional hard points and the other software involved, there's more to it than that. But we, like we've learned in a lot of things, we say things like rewinging, and we really mean rebuilding the zero timing the airframes and building them back up to spec. So.
So here's a question, David. Will the F-15 be able to be refueled by the new tanker whenever that comes out that you love so much?
They've already refueled F-15s with the KC-46.
That's good. I know you love those old tanker stories.
Martin remembers.
Martin, you've been around way too long. You know.
All right. So we've got an item from USA Today. The title is, with his time on Air Force One short, Obama touts new airline regulations, and the president recently described some new regulations aimed at increasing airline competition, protecting customer interests, they include things like refunds on checked bag fees, airlines publishing more information about on-time arrivals, protections for disabled passengers, and greater transparency for online ticket platforms. But let's look at each of these a little bit and see what we think. The first one is a refund of checked bag fees if your bags are delayed. So I guess,
yeah, it seems like a no-brainer.
Exactly.
Doesn't that? Yeah. Is there anybody that thinks that's a bad idea?
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
No, I think it's just a definition of when's a bag late. And to me, a bag's late when it's not on the same plane as I am.
Yeah.
Yeah, there still needs to be some definition on that. The article says that the DOT, the Department of Transportation, still has to define details about how late does the bag have to be before it's considered a late bag. But I think the basic idea is that if you're paying to check a bag, if you're paying a fee for that, then the bag is late, then you're not getting the service that you paid for.
You know, if Amazon promises to ship a package to you and they aren't able to meet those requirements, they do provide a refund of shipping. So I think it falls under that same boat of, you know, they didn't promise a service and they they should be required to pay up.
The next one is that airlines have to publish more information about their on-time arrivals and lost baggage rates. So that's kind of a performance transparency issue.
So as the rule is written now, a major carrier like Delta or United or American that has regional airline partners does not have to include their regional airline partners in the reports they make to the DOT. So a SkyWest, an Endeavor, an Envoy, any of the regional air carriers, even though they operate on behalf of the major carrier, they are not included in the major carrier's on-time calculations or cancellation calculations. So what this rule would do would essentially require the air carriers to include those numbers in their larger numbers.
That's interesting, yeah.
It allows the airlines to kind of cheat when they say, and you know, up until the computer meltdown a few months ago, Delta in particular has been one to tout their 100% cancel-free operation. But in reality, when you delve down into the numbers, Delta just passes on the cancellations. The first thing they will do is go to their regional carriers and say, okay, you need to cancel X number of flights today. We're only operating mainline aircraft.
The thing that I have, or the problem that I have with this, is when I go to book my ticket on most of the airline's websites that I use, it'll show the percentage of on-time performance for that flight. And although I don't know over what period of time they're looking at, and probably if I looked into the details, I could find that. But to me, it really doesn't matter, because the only thing that matters is the flight I'm on today going to be delayed or not? If a flight's delayed 30% of the time and another one's 10% of the time, because of the time of day and or the price, I'm still end up booking the 30% delayed flight and going to take it and just hope that it lands on time.
What other option do you have, I guess, right?
I guess choose a different carrier, different flight. But I don't know. I just don't see that many choices that meet the requirements that I have. So to me, this whole thing is kind of meaningless.
For you personally?
Yeah, for me personally.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And your flying habits. All right. Well, another item here is protection for travelers with disabilities. And this includes things like bathrooms that are not accessible to the handicapped.
What about bathrooms that aren't accessible to normal size people? The new lavatories are so incredibly small. They need to be regulated and a few more inches given.
Tight fit for you, huh, Brian?
It's just pathetic when you can't turn around inside a toilet these days. Not the actual bowl. I'm talking about the room.
Yeah, sure. I kind of got that part. So.
Just waiting for Max T to say something.
Yeah, I want more details and more information about that. Oh, no, wait. No, I don't.
But seriously, another aspect of this is things like in-flight entertainment that doesn't provide accommodations for blind or deaf passengers.
I think the biggest part of this article and the biggest thing that's gotten a lot of attention in the frequent flyer community is the clamping down and the limit of use of emotional support animals. And the ease of use of emotional support animals that's currently out there. And you've seen there have been many different news stories that have been out there lately with regard to large emotional support animals that aren't dogs. Most recently, it was the emotional support duck.
Yes.
That went flying on Delta.
Or pot-belly pig or snake.
Are we talking about the in-flight meals, or are we talking about... I mean, nice. I think that's a good way of supporting the passengers. Let's have some foie gras, you know, as it walks down the aisle.
I think, you know, and it's not to degrade anyone that has a medical condition that requires the support of an emotional support animal, but there are verifiable conditions that have that, and that the animal does serve a very large purpose. But for the number of people that do have that, there are probably more people that are out there that are able to go online, register their animal as an emotional support animal, just so that they can either bring the pet on the airplane for free or to be able to skirt around the regulations pertaining to having the pet in a carrier. And so there are a lot of potential complications that are out there to the emotional support animal kind of quandary of what conditions require the use of a support animal. And it's not just support, emotional support, but animals can provide any number of other support items. And how do you clamp down on the faking of use of emotional support animals that people can and will engage in? I tell the story in class, and I it's one of my favorite stories of the potential issues of this, but I had a friend in college who wanted to get around the regulations of her apartment building of not being able to have a dog, and she tried to register the dog as an emotional support animal, but she realized as a pilot she would not be able to get a medical certificate if she had any of the conditions that required the support animal around. So, it's kind of a double-edged sword for that kind of situation, but I can go online tonight and register my dog as an emotional support animal, who you've probably heard in the background at random points during the podcast. or we could go online and, report any of your animals as emotional support animals, and they would theoretically be allowed on the airplane, even though there's no condition out there that I currently suffer from that would require me to have the dog around, other than the fact that I love my dog.
Yeah.
I think there is a need for this because people are using the system and taking advantage of the system when there are people that really do need it that can't or that are suffering because they can't do it anyways or they can't bring the dog on board anyways.
Years ago we took a very young cat, a kitten, on board, and it was in the carrier and it was under the seat and all that kind of stuff. And afterwards we brought him up and we opened it up, put our hand in. If you want to be a pariah on an aircraft, bring your toddler. You want to be a rock star, bring your kitten. Everybody was just so thrilled to see that cat. They had the best time.
Yeah, it's clear that certain people really do require support animals, emotional support animals, for very valid reasons. And it's really unfortunate that others who are trying to game the system or abuse the system, I guess is maybe a better way to describe it, potentially are going to ruin it for some of the people who really need it. But so it'll be interesting to see how the DOT handles this without hurting the people that actually need support animals. It's a tough one.
And the other thing is, these emotional support animals that are serving, or support animals in general that are serving a legitimate purpose, are incredibly highly trained. They're desensitized to a lot of the environments that someone who's in that situation will need. And the easiest way to spot those kind of situations is, how does the dog react when it's in the airport? If a dog that is an emotional support animal or other support animal that is well trained to just get the person to the gate and onto the airplane, that's one thing. But I've traveled enough to see dogs that are not even potty trained, that will let loose on the floor, that will bark at people, that will snap at people. And I think that's kind of what these new regulations are also intended to move towards, is if you have a legitimate need for it, there are many organizations out there that do fantastic work that will provide you with an animal that is incredibly well-trained to be able to handle that. And I encourage people that have a demonstrated need for that to search out their local organizations that will provide those at a low cost or no cost to individuals that need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with you.
Yeah. All right. The last item from that article that we'll mention is a proposal that requires, more transparency for online ticket platforms. Some airlines don't make their fares available for comparison, and the Department of Transportation is looking for comments on whether they should be required to do so.
Yeah, and I'd say no. I think it's up to the airlines to distribute their product however they want. For example, Southwest generally doesn't provide their information to any GDS, and I think that's okay if that's their business model and that's what they want to do. However, if an airline wants to have their prices published and the ticketing agency doesn't take their information, I have a problem with that much more so than the other way around.
I was going to go ahead and add, if a passenger is going to southwest.com to book a ticket, they're wanting to fly on Southwest. There's no real impetus for them to have the price for Delta or any of the other carriers listed right there. Yeah. If I want that, I'll go to the other airline's website, or I'll go to Travelocity or any of the other number of airfare booking sites.
Right. And I think that's it. They want Southwest pricing to be put on the Travelocity, for example, website. And that's just something I don't agree with. Now, if Travelocity says, no, we won't take your pricing, that I do have a problem with. But it's up to the business to run their airline and sell their tickets however they want. I just like the last line in this story where it says airlines oppose many of these new rules. They say that it'll interfere with their marketing strategies. What a bunch of hooey that is. Jeez.
and that strategy is to extract as much profit. And I guess that's the bottom line. Isn't that what they're really trying to do?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And keep things as opaque as possible.
Yep.
All right. Well, we see in the Wichita Eagle that Bombardier plans to shed thousands of jobs through 2018. This is a big number that spans both of the aircraft and rail segments of Bombardier, maybe 7,500 jobs to be cut back.
Well, we all know the businesses are cyclical, and that Bombardier has not been doing as well as some of the other manufacturers. And, of course, they acquired Learjet a while back ago, so that impacts them as well. So, yeah, it's I feel for these folks. It's not fun being in an industry that goes up and down.
Yeah, and this certainly is a cyclical industry, as we all know. And certainly those of us who have worked in the industry knows, with layoffs and furloughs and then rehirings and things like that, following the business cycles, it's a tough business. If you're one of the 7,500 folks at Bombardier that are going to be looking for new employment, it's a tough thing.
You know, and I was just thinking back to my years when I was working at HP Hewlett Packard, and we would have layoffs announced. And I think the tough part was just kind of the waiting. You know, now the whole company is probably sitting there going, oh my gosh, will it be me? And it may be months or years before some of those people find out, oh, it's me, or it's not me. And that's just unfortunate to leave people, in limbo for that long. You know, I think it really affects them in their gut and in their performance and their happiness. And it's like, it's so much better when they just, roll these things out quickly and get it over with. Everybody can deal with it instead of, it's almost the anticipation, I think, is almost worse than the actual, occurrence itself.
Don't forget survivor's guilt.
Yep.
And then the people left behind have to end up doing two and three people's jobs as well. So, there's a whole bunch of problems with this.
That's the weird thing, because I think there are times when the people left behind are feeling worse off than the people who, got let go, especially if they got let go with any kind of severance.
Yeah, well, that happened to me. I came into work one day and suddenly I got put into HR and said, your job description changed as of this morning. And then later on in the afternoon, everybody who had my previous job description pretty much got escorted out of the building.
Wow.
Yeah.
And trust me, I didn't feel good for a couple of months afterwards. There's survivor's guilt. You just sort of go, okay, why did I get picked and not somebody else,
Well, if there's anybody listening from Bombardier, hang in there. This too will pass. Things will work out. It's, it's just unfortunate that there's always uncertainty and doubt leading up to it.
All right. An item from Fortune. Hawaiian Airlines will continue to assign flight seats based on passenger weight. Huh. Is this about like weight and balance or something?
I was going to say, does that mean if I gain a whole bunch of weight, they'll put me in first class? No, I guess that's something different. Okay.
That's a riot. Yeah. there's an incentive to pick up pounds. Yeah, it's all about weight and balance. And part of it is that people are getting larger. There have been some plane crashes on the record. There was a charter flight crash in the Bahamas, as I recall, with some rock singer and that person's entourage. And, all the bodyguards were, 300 pounds, and the standard weights that they used for planning the flight were either 170 or 200 pounds. And so, this is an issue. People are getting larger, and, that's even more true. It's a bigger issue with the smaller airplanes, and if you happen to be going to destinations where you've got bigger people. So I kind of wonder if we're going to see more of this in other places in the future. This could possibly be something that we'll see happen more and more.
Again, we're speaking with Martin Rotler. He's a lecturer and the industry relations coordinator for the Ohio State University's Center for Aviation Studies in Columbus, Ohio. Martin, I remembered that it's the Ohio State University.
Thank you. If you don't put the, they dock a dime from my paycheck.
I remember that from last time. So it has been a while since we've talked to you. So maybe you can give us all a little refresher on what the Center for Aviation Studies is all about.
So in the aviation program at Ohio State, under the banner of the Ohio State University Center for Aviation Studies, we have a degree program for students that are seeking professional pilot or management or operations track, airport planning, airport management, careers. We have about 260 students spread out across three colleges. We're a unique program offering out there that has a Bachelor of Science degree through our College of Engineering, a Bachelor of Arts degree in Air Transportation through our College of Arts and Sciences, and a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration through our Fisher College of Business. And for those students that are looking at professional flight degrees, we do offer our flight training through the Ohio State University Airport, which we also concurrently own and operate at the same time as offering aviation education. In addition to our majors, we also offer a minor for students that are interested in learning to speak a little bit more the language of aviation. And it's a very common option for students to get the minor, and actually they can earn their private pilot's license as part of the minor as well.
Hmm.
So we have at any given time about 100 kids in our flight program. And at last check, I think 17 or 18 airplanes out at the airport, including five brand new Cessna 172s equipped with the Garmin G1000 system on board, a couple of steam gauge 172s that we'll be keeping in our fleet as well for the foreseeable future to ensure that students get the best of both worlds, and to ensure that I will be able to fly them while I continue to peruse Max Trescott's G1000 book, trying to understand how things work. So we have a good portion of our students will be management and operations focused in addition to our professional pilot kids. So career tracks for students that are going out, the flight students will go flight instruct, fly cargo before going to the regional carriers. Our management students will go business aviation, airports, airlines, Part 135 operators. We've had a pretty mixed bag of students that have gone to any number of different places.
Hmm. It's really a pretty comprehensive set of programs, I think, where you can progress to a wide variety of different aviation careers.
You know, the world is your oyster. And when I talk to students, prospective students about it, it's it's not just airlines. It becomes very hard for those of us that have kind of the airline mentality to say, oh, you just want to go to an airline and be that way. But the aviation industry is so much more than that. And it's been fun over the last 5 years so that I've been there to see where everyone ends up. I mean, we have students that are working for NetJets in management roles. We have other students that are being very successful working for the air carriers in revenue management and network planning. In addition to the kids that are going out there and flying every day and are now flying the line, I've not yet run into one who's flying my airplane, but we'll get to that point eventually where it'll be one of my students in the front of the airplane flying me around. And it's a cool thing to be a part of, and it's a cool thing to kind of pass that on, because we do get exposure to any of the number of other 65,000 students on campus and 35,000 faculty and staff that are at the university.
Is there a way to characterize what the students are like these days? It might be difficult because there are so many different kinds of programs, and maybe different students have different objectives. But what are students like these days who get into programs like this?
The aviation students who say, I want to be a pilot when I grow up, which is a bit of a misnomer because pilots never grow up. but those that are in the industry, they have a lot of passion. And so one of the things that I can tell with a lot of our students is that they have a lot of passion, and it takes just a little bit of time, a little bit of effort to kind of help them and direct that passion in the right locations.
Hmm.
They want to go out. They want to do internships. They want to experience everything that they can. And for a good portion of them, that's pretty easy for them to do through student organizations and other opportunities. But there's also some students that need the little bit of extra push or the kick in the butt to get everything going that they need to make in their career choices.
We talk about the pilot shortage or the impending pilot shortage or the pilot shortage that's existing in maybe the regionals now. Do you see students coming in because they perceive that there are lots of opportunities for pilots because there's a shortfall?
We get some of that, and that is increasing with some of our younger kids. We also get some students that will come in and still think that, you know, it's $20,000 a year, your first year, and they don't want that. And that is no longer the case for a lot of the regional carriers. They're bumped up their pay to $35,000, $40,000, $45,000, $50,000, $55,000 a year your first year. It's the big problem with a lot of the students that I think that will come into any major aviation university is that they will get to campus, they'll say, I want to fly, and they're either not used to the stringent training structure of a Part 141 program, or they see the numbers on a page of how much flight training costs in addition to university tuition. But when it comes time to actually start paying those bills, they have to step back and go, whoa, that's a lot of money.
What about the pilot cadet programs? I see in the news that you signed some agreements with a number of airlines. What is that program all about?
So at Ohio State, we've signed agreements with five different airlines, SkyWest, Republic, and all three of American's wholly owned carriers, PSA, Piedmont, and Envoy. And each one of those programs offers a different level of benefits to the students. The current kind of iteration of a lot of these cadet programs is that a student will interview in their sophomore or junior year after they've earned their pilot's license, their private pilot's license, and as they're working on their instrument and commercial, and they will either get a tentative job offer or a guaranteed interview with the company. This is moving a little bit and swinging a little bit more to being far more lucrative and beneficial for students, however, where you begin to see the three American wholly owned airlines in their cadet programs will offer students who earn their CFI certificate and flight instruct for the universities a tuition reimbursement of $5,000. And that's an incentive that they earn a certain amount of money after every 100 hours that they fly. So once they hit 500 hours, they get a certain amount of money. And then they hit another 100 hours, they get a certain amount of money as they're flight instructing, which is something that is very new. So the trend has been to offering more and more lucrative stuff. The other carriers, SkyWest will offer, they'll fly their cadets to the company headquarters in St. George, Utah, and give them a company introduction and an initial ground school. Republic Airways has offered our cadets that are signed on through them or are interested students opportunities to go to their headquarters in Indianapolis. They've also offered and had students travel to Indianapolis for other kind of fun social events like practice runs at the Indy 500 track. So, you know, it's the airlines, it's a unique situation because the airlines themselves tend to be fairly conservative in how they've recruited in the past. And this is an opportunity for them to kind of get creative. And how do you better align with the millennials that are out there that are active on social media, that are very aware and have easy access to the internet to say, and they're asking really good questions with that too, and saying, why should I choose your company now over another company? And so it's really requiring these carriers to kind of be innovative in how they approach the situation. And, you know, we're always willing to talk about how to make that more innovative and more beneficial on both sides of the spectrum for the air carrier, the university, and for the students. But, you know, the biggest hindrance, I think, to most of the university students that are out there are still cost. It is anywhere between $50,000 and $70,000 on top of tuition, no matter where you go, whether you go to an Ohio State, a North Dakota, an Embry-Riddle, a SIU Carbondale, a Purdue, it's going to be that amount of money in some range thereof. So, you know, how do you offset that? How do you make the willingness to invest that much money in an education? You know, if I can guarantee an incoming freshman and tell their parents and look their parents in the eye and say, your student, if they make the right decisions in college, could have a job offer in their sophomore year of college, that makes them a lot more willing to invest the money in a collegiate education as opposed to without that. And, you know, there are carriers that are out there. The three American wholly owns, they advertise this fact, and it is, you know, the practical elements of it are still kind of dependent on the airline, but it is entirely reasonable that if you were a cadet hired with PSA Piedmont or Envoy, that would be your last job interview you'd ever have, and you'd automatically flow up to American when the time comes.
Hmm. Interesting.
And it's a crazy time, and the pilot shortage is real, despite what some people will say. You know, the students that are sitting in my introduction to aviation class that are freshmen and sophomores right now, if they make the right decisions and they continue on the track, they could be at a major carrier in 5 to 7 years from where they're sitting in the classroom. It's a crazy time in the industry, and barring any major economic downturn, catastrophic economic downturn, I would even say these students are going to have opportunities far into the future.
Yeah, Martin, what I'm interested in is how do they get the hours? Because even when they graduate from The Ohio State University, don't they still need 1,250 hours?
A lot of them, we fall under the restricted ATP program through the FAA, so they'll need fewer. But they will graduate with somewhere between 250 to 300 hours is the most common. And so most of the students will go and flight instruct because it's an easy transition from living as a poor, starving college student to living as a poor, starving flight instructor. And for a lot of our students, especially too, where they have, you know, campus life that they enjoy and student life that they enjoy, mainly Saturdays during the fall, they can make that transition fairly easily. So they'll be flight instructing. We have other students that will go fly cargo, 135 cargo, skydivers, any number of other kind of opportunities that are out there. And I always encourage everyone to say never turn down an opportunity for free flight time either. Because that 1 hour that you fly punching holes in the sky as a safety pilot is an hour that you don't necessarily have to spend sitting as a flight instructor.
Martin, what about diversity? Are you seeing any trends in terms of gender or minorities that maybe have been kind of underrepresented in commercial aviation, let's say?
I am seeing some of the initial reaches out, and a lot of that comes on the backs of some amazing organizations that are out there trying to improve things. And I include within that Women in Aviation, the Organization of Black Aviation Professionals, OBAP, and the National Gay Pilots Association being three of kind of the most prominent ones that are making a conscious effort to reach out into the community. And we're making that conscious effort as well. But it takes a lot of work to kind of create something that used to be a club of old white guys to something that is far more inclusive for everyone.
Great. Now, you've been spending your summers in Korea, I believe, in a summer program there?
Yes, the south of Korea, not the north.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Just to clarify that. Yes, I since 2013, I have served and been lucky enough to serve as a visiting professor in the Korea Aerospace University's International Summer Program. So what it offers to college students from all over the world, even non-aviation college students, is an opportunity to study for a month at a university in South Korea. They live there. I live there too. And we take 3 or 4 weeks of classes in aviation taught in English. And in past years, I've taught airline management, aviation safety and security, airline labor relations, as well as aviation and tourism to a wide audience of diverse individuals from around the world. And they also include some really awesome, awesome field experiences with that too. Once-in-a-lifetime opportunities that I've been lucky enough to experience on multiple occasions now. But things like tours, behind-the-scenes tours of the Incheon Airport. This year, we got to go see Korean Air's flight training facility on the Korean island of Jeju, which is Korea's Hawaii. So we actually got to get on a 777 on the way down and a 747 on the way back for the 45-minute flight from Seoul to Jeju and back. And this year, we also got to go explore Korean Air's new flight simulator facility near the Incheon Airport. And all of the students, we weren't expecting it, but they surprised us, had the opportunity to fly the sims if they wanted to. So I myself got to experience two wonderful landings in the Airbus A380 and landed the airplane better in the A380 than I did in a 172.
How's your Korean? Are you able to pick up some of the language?
I now speak what I call survival Korean, so nice. I can do basic business introductions, and I'm at a 98% rate of ordering in restaurants and getting what I ordered.
Good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a fantastic experience. You know, I always encourage students to take the opportunity to travel abroad. I think this is the only aviation-specific study abroad in the world. That offers students the opportunity to study aviation in a different environment. There are aviation programs around the world, but this is one that's devoted specifically to the international set.
Great.
Do you think we might be able to clone that program and maybe set something up similar, maybe at the University of Hawaii or something like that? 'Cause I am on board already, if that's the case. I'd like to spend the summer there.
I would love that. Maybe not the summer. I'd like to spend the winter there.
Yeah, well, that's fine. So you could summer in Seoul and winter at, Maui or something like that.
Well, this year was really funny. I actually took a week of vacation. I cashed in every single frequent flyer mile I had. I should have written it off as a business expense, but I got to fly down to Melbourne, Australia for vacation and had an opportunity to experience from Korean summer, which is hot and humid, to Australian winter, which is chilly and not as humid. But got to meet with an aviation university there, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and talk to them about maybe there's an opportunity for programs there or there's an opportunity for students to come to the United States as well. The aviation world is increasingly becoming smaller and smaller, so I always encourage students and other aviation professionals to reach out and look around. And it was a great opportunity for me because I got to fly in Air China's business class, Thai Airways business class, and most importantly, Thai Airways first class.
Ooh.
For a whopping 90,000 miles, and I realized I had to spend 90,000 miles of champagne drinking in Thai Airways first class on a 5.5-hour flight.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, yep.
All right, so I'm thinking new business opportunity, guys, here. It's the Airplane Geeks traveling lecture series that goes around the world. And Martin, I think we're going to pull you in and make that part of the program.
I'll happily do it. So some of the other stuff, I would also make a pitch out to some of the other stuff that we're doing that's out there in the environment. The OSU Aviation Program has a ton of research that's been going on, and that's been a big change since I started and back when I was a guest in 2011. I think the program did about $300,000 in research, maybe, if that. And now we're in the $1 million, $2 million plus range per year. Where we are conducting some pretty major research for the FAA in areas of general aviation. We're part of the Center of Excellence for General Aviation Research. So we've done research in weather technology in the cockpits, putting in potentially angle of attack equipment. And one of my other colleagues has been spearheading that. Actually, a couple of my colleagues have been spearheading those efforts. We also are, through our aerospace engineering program, doing a little bit of research in unmanned aerial systems. We are a part of the ASURUS, which is the FAA Center of Excellence for UAV research. And we are, I think they've done it once, one of the only airports in the country that the FAA has actually given us the okay to, on the north side of our airport, use UASs, and on the south side, potentially look at researching the use of manned aircraft and managing both at the same time.
Do you have a program for UAS at this point or just doing research as part of other?
We do not. There is another program that we've kind of not deferred to, but there's a big competitive program in Dayton through Sinclair Community College that has been doing a ton of UAS stuff, and they have a pretty significant program. But our students have been looped in, obviously with some of the more serious research and the more serious unmanned systems. They need a certified pilot, and it's pretty easy to go find a kid that'll say, hey, do you want to go fly a UAS for 10 or 15 bucks an hour? And all you need is a private pilot's license or a commercial pilot's license, and they'll happily do it.
All right, Martin, tell our listeners where they can learn more about the Ohio State University's programs in aviation.
Okay, aviation.osu.edu is our website, and you can find more information there about our degrees. We're also on Facebook. You can like us at the Ohio State University Center for Aviation Studies. We have a Twitter account that is at @CAS_OSU, and we have an Instagram account whose username is escaping me at the moment. But if you just search, I think it's OSU Center for Aviation Studies. So you can follow us there, like us there. Feel free to reach out to us. There's a page for requesting more information if you're a prospective student. We're happy to hear from you. If you are interested in any kind of information, we're there to help.
Ian, how about you personally online?
All of my stuff is very easy to remember. My personal website, martinrotler.net, which doesn't have much information on it. But you can find me actively tweeting at martinrotler. I'm also on Instagram at Martin Rotler, and you can find me on both of those pages.
Great. And we'll have all those links in the show notes. So if you're trying to remember all of those, don't worry. Just visit airplanegeeks.com/424. That's the episode number. And we'll have all those contact points that Martin just mentioned. So, Martin, we really want to thank you for giving us some updates on what's going on at the Ohio State University. Maybe we'll promise not to wait another couple of years before we have you back on again.
I'm always happy to come back and join the fun.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with, well, his segment. What do we have this week, David?
A rant.
A rant from David? Really?
This week, this conspiracy theorist came out to play. VFC-12 debuted a new camouflage scheme based on the Su-34 fullbacks seen in action over Syria. Photos of the new camo appeared first on Facebook on a page that's dedicated to adversary and aggressor aircraft. The photos somehow then were hijacked into a story about U.S. planning a false flag operation in Syria. What is a false flag? Well, it stems from naval warfare. When a sailing vessel would hoist a pennant so the enemy would see and think the vessel friendly, then once alongside begin bombardment and hoist the proper colors, like the Jolly Roger. The term now has been broadened to include all special ops in the clandestine world. Since 9/11/2001, the term has been hijacked by people who believe the World Trade Center attacks were done by the United States so we could attack the Middle East, or chemtrails exist and the Apollo moon landings were hoaxes. So let's get something straight right from the top. Painting an aircraft in a foreign nation's specifications and national insignias and operating it in that way is an act of war and can be considered a war crime. In 1923, The Hague proposed the following rules for air warfare. Though never formally adopted, they had become accepted as precedent. Article 3 was, a military aircraft must carry an exterior mark indicating its nationality and military character, i.e. the U.S. star and bar. Article 19, the use of false exterior marks is forbidden. This is very much the standard policy for the United States. In fact, aircraft that are built in the U.S. tend to be delivered to a foreign nation wearing U.S. markings if the delivery is being flown by U.S. pilots. But back to VFC-12's fullback scheme. Yes, we paint our airplanes in foreign camouflage to learn. They often have red stars on the tails and big Bort numbers on the noses. Why do we do that? One, how do you identify and fight an aircraft in that camo? And secondly, how do you differentiate a similar aircraft when you're flying DACT or dissimilar aircraft combat training, a.k.a. dogfighting? But to quote a very famous movie on the subject, on March 3, 1969, the United States Navy established an elite school for the top 1% of its pilots. Its purpose was to teach the lost art of aerial combat and to ensure a handful of men who graduated were the best fighter pilots in the world. Today, the Navy calls it the Fighter Weapons School. The Flyers call it Top Gun. Yes, I know right now you're hearing that music in your head, but back to the subject at hand. The U.S. Navy was almost to a 1-to-1 ratio of kills versus losses in the Vietnam conflict, meaning that every enemy shot down, the North Vietnamese would shoot down one of our aircraft. The Navy, under the orders of Admiral Tom Moore, who was Chief of Naval Operations, began a review of air-to-air engagements with missiles. Moore put Captain Frank Ott in charge of the study. The implication was the technology was at fault, not the pilots. The report had five challenges. Is the industry delivering to the Navy a product built to specifications? Are the fleet support missions supporting the carriers and land bases correctly? Are the squadrons and ships putting the missile systems into play properly? Does the combat air crew fully and exploit the capabilities of the aircraft and missile systems? And lastly, are the air-to-air missile systems being properly maintained? There were issues with the Sparrow and Sidewinders, but the real issue was question four. The pilots had lost the skills of dogfight. The Navy had disestablished the Fleet Air Gunnery Units, which trained pilots in dogfighting. The logic was, the faulty logic, that aircraft didn't need a gun any longer and missiles would eliminate the need for close-in dogfighting. The final report suggested there was a need for those skills and suggested the creation of an advanced fighter weapons school. That school, originally based at Miramar Naval Air Station, became Top Gun. By the way, if you don't know, the school is Top Gun, all one word. The movie is Top Space Gun. In parallel, for the same reasons, the United States Air Force began Project Red Baron 1, followed by Baron 2 and Baron 3. The United States Air Force took a slightly different tact. The Air Force created Operation Red Flag, a full-scale war simulation. It was concluded that the pilot was most likely lost in their first 10 combat missions. What Red Flag does is to give those pilots those first 10 missions and the ability to make those mistakes so when they are in actual combat, they will have that experience under their belt. Both Top Gun and Red Flag began with the same aircraft, the T-38 Talon. It was the perfect MiG-21 simulator. With it came the tradition of painting the aircraft in various camouflages. The Navy had more freedom and were more random as the fighter weapon school adversaries. The Air Force had specs made and eventually for their aggressors. The Air Force had paint schemes like Flogger, Silver, Grape, and Snake. Fast forward to the present day. The Navy, with the creation of the strike fighter community, Legacy, and Super Hornets, moved Top Gun from Miramar to Naval Air Station Fallon. Fallon was where the Attack Strike U pilots would do advanced training, as well as the E-2 community, Top Dome. NSOC, or NSAWC, was created. The Naval Strike and Air Warfare Center retains the whole carrier air wing now and gives them the same training as you would get from Red Flag. NSOC uses F-16s and F-18s painted as foreign aircraft, but with U.S. markings. Besides NSOC, the Navy has three VFC, or composite squadrons, 111, the Sundowners, 13, the Saints, and 12, Ambush, to provide training for the fleet beyond Fallon. VFC-12 is based at Naval Air Station Oceana, VFC-111 is out at Naval Air Station Key West, and VFC-13 is based at Naval Air Station Fallon and supplements NSOC. Based out of Yuma, the United States Marine Corps also has VMFT-401. The snipers provide adversary training to Marine Corps units. Red Flag occurs at least four times a year at Nelson and Ellison air bases. These days, it's not only is it open to U.S. squadrons of all branches, but foreign allies also. F-16s now act as simulators for the MiG-29 fulcrums and F-15s as Su-25 and Su-35 flankers. All branches paint their aircraft in current schemes. The Air Force has fulcrum schemes and have updated them often. VFC-111 painted one of their F-5NFs in a scheme just recently seen on the Sukhoi PAC-T-50, and VFC-12 has had the black, gray, and white splinter on their F-18A pluses. Their B-plus was what received the blue scheme seen on the Su-34 fullback. Given our pilots operating in close proximity to Russian aircraft over the Syrian landscape, painting up one of our Hornets is the best thing that could happen. So our pilots don't shoot first and ask questions later, causing an international incident. So we're not planning to bomb Syria, we're actually learning how not to shoot the wrong people. Vietnam reminded us we needed to go back to the old motto, fight like you train and train like you fight. So with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof, debunking another conspiracy theory, signing off.
Wow, David. Thank you. You connected a lot of dots, at least for me anyway. That was really fascinating. You mentioned, what, Fallon?
Naval Air Station Fallon, yes.
Where is that?
It is in Nevada. And it is actually, the Naval Air Station has a big operating field like Nellis does for air combat, and they have something called ACMI pods, which are air combat instrumentation, and you can see things like watch the dogfight in real time, and they record the simulated missile shots. It's a very computerized system that the Navy took and learned from the Red Flag weapon systems.
Wow.
So I was thinking as I was looking back on this, and I actually didn't end up pulling it up on Google. What this had me thinking of was the situations where we've captured or otherwise acquired enemy, quote-unquote enemy aircraft, and looking to see how we painted them. And it looks like, at least with the MiG-15 that was flown over from North Korea in the 1950s, that we repainted it in full U.S. Air Force colors.
We did. And believe it or not, that MiG-15, that MiG-15 was also, as well as we had a lot of captured aircraft. We received some MiG-17s, which were used as adversaries, as well as MiG-21s and MiG-23s. The Air Force Museum MiG-23 Flogger actually was used in Nellis as a YF-113. Which was a captured aircraft, and it did have markings, U.S. markings on it. They've repainted it back to the original Soviet markings. When we sent Hab Donut, which is the MiG-17, back to Israel so they could test fly it, it got Stars of David on it, and then it was sent back to the United States and got American markings. Anytime we've flown a captured aircraft going all the way back to World War II, it's had U.S. markings on it, BF-109s, Focke-Wulfs. Interestingly enough, the Germans flew B-17s over in Europe that were captured and they rebuilt. And they put them in German markings, but they would go up and shadow the bomber streams for reconnaissance. B-17 bomber crews would report that they saw a strange marked B-17 or a strange marked B-24, and what they were there was a group called KG-200 in the Luftwaffe in World War II, and they actually flew missions where they would put these captured aircraft up into the bomber streams for reconnaissance. But in accordance to law, they had full swastikas and Luftwaffe crosses on all of their markings. But the bomber crews would look, well, it's a B-17, but it looks funny, but, you know, it's a B-17. So what would, I mean, it's just, we're just imagining it. So there's a long history of using aircraft in different markings. And it's one of those things that I've always liked. I have a couple of models that I built as a kid or as an adult that are captured aircraft, from HE-162s in British markings to P-47s in German markings, the Focke-Wulfs in American Navy markings, you know, they painted. So there's a whole tradition, but never, ever has anyone actually painted up an American airplane to look like a Russian aircraft and flown it to pretend and make it look like the Russians were committing atrocities, be it Soviets, Cold Wars, or anything. Everybody's pretty above board on that. So now, a lot of times, what's happened, there is a corollary to this. And this is something the Israelis will do, and this is something the United States has done in the past, which is you can paint out the markings occasionally, so you or tape over the markings so it's not identifiable, but that's sort of hedging the bets. You're not really repainting it into somebody else's markings. You're just covering up your own.
Fine distinction there.
So I'm going to put my tinfoil away back in the drawer now.
Yeah, David.
Yeah, and I'm going to stop flying for that company that wanted me to put more chemtrails up there. The checks kept bouncing anyway, so I was kind of suspicious that it wasn't real.
Chemtrails. All right. I just wanted to mention that I was a guest on another podcast. You all probably remember Nicholas Jackson. He was a guest on our show. He's a flight sim guy, and he does the FS in Focus or Flight Sim in Focus podcast. And I was on the show that aired live on Sky Blue Radio October 15th, 2016. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. There were I guess three segments to the show. The first one was with actually Captain Nick from the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. He was on. And then I start about a little over an hour into the program, if you want to go straight to that, talking about jet engines and how they work and everything. And then the third segment was Tracy Schiffman from VATSIM's World Flight charity group. We've talked about World Flight in the past and that charity. So we'll have links to or a link to that that episode in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/424. We were hoping to have a report from Rob on his Dassault Falcon 8X experience. At least, do we know for sure that he actually made it over there and flew the jet?
He posted some pictures of his experience on social media. I know that.
Great. Then he made it. So we'll have to wait for next week for Rob to give us that report. I was all excited. My Aviation Week appeared today in the mailbox, and the Falcon 8X is featured on the cover of this latest Aviation Week. Let's see. Max West, what's going on with you these days?
Oh, I have to report that I got a new piece of plastic in the mail today. And we've talked about this in the past, and it turns out that I am not an operator. According to my new UAS certificate, it says I'm a remote pilot. So just wanted to let you know.
Really? It says remote pilot? Yeah.
That's exactly what it says. Just about the largest letters on the certificate say that. Interestingly, the certificate number is different from the three other similar-looking certificates I have in my wallet for being a pilot, a flight instructor, and a ground instructor. Those three are all the same, but they issued a totally new number for this one. And the other thing is, along the right-hand side, very large letters in white, it says UAS. None of the other certificates have anything on that part of the certificate. So I guess they wanted to really make it immediately obvious to an FAA inspector or anybody else that, hey, this is different. This is not one of the regular certificates you're used to looking at. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, boy, I have had two encounters in the last 3 weeks with hot props. And anybody who doesn't know about that, let me just mention briefly that if you're flying a piston aircraft, that even when everything is shut down, if you go out there and turn the propeller, the magnetos are still generating sparks. And the two safeguards are that the magneto switch, the key is in the off position, which grounds both sets of magnetos, so that spark does not make it to the spark plugs. And if you shut the engine down properly by pulling the mixture and then waiting for the engine to stop before you turn off the key, you've prevented any fuel from getting into the cylinders. And if you don't, you know, if those two safeguards are gone and you happen to bump the prop, it can start for a second or two and kill you. So it's a hot prop is a really, really dangerous situation. So yesterday I was in a Cirrus, a brand new one. It was about a year old. And I had been in one flight earlier in the day in the right seat. And the second flight, I was in the left seat because I was checking out a flight instructor who wanted to fly from the right seat. And so I went to put the key in for him. And I realized, oh, my gosh, this key, the lock, you know, the switch is in the both position. So the prior person was able to pull the key out in the both position instead of turning it to the off position, which meant when he went to push the aircraft back, he had a hot prop. And neither of us had noticed. He'd pulled the key out in the wrong position. It's not supposed to let you do that, but this switch was apparently damaged in a way that lets you pull the key out in something other than the off position. So very dangerous. We've grounded the aircraft so that nobody, you know, accidentally kills themselves. And then the other one was just 3 weeks ago. I was doing the mag check, which I've done on every flight for, you know, 40 years. First time ever it didn't pass. The In one of the positions, one of the ground wires apparently was broken, and we switched to that position, and there was not a decrease in RPM, which told us, hey, we had a hot prop as well. So two hot props in 3 weeks, very, very, very unusual. So wow. I mentioned it only to let pilots out there, you know, be very careful and be, you know, particularly, you know, attentive to make sure the key comes out in the off position and that, you know, you don't inadvertently have a hot prop.
Good advice.
All right, Brian, you've been traveling a lot lately.
I have, and kind of ran into an issue with my flight to Singapore, and that ended up getting canceled. And I did go to Hong Kong, and I was supposed to get together with listener James. And unfortunately, when I was in Hong Kong, my travel got changed yet again. So I ended up missing getting together with him. So I just wanted to just acknowledge that James and I were supposed to get together, and I feel really bad about not being able to do that. However, when I was in Hong Kong, I got to do two things that were really cool. One of them, got a tour of Cathay City, so the little village that Cathay Airlines has built, and got to take a tour of the flight sims that they have there, and they have a whole bunch of them, and didn't get to fly one, but saw them in action, a bunch of pilots doing their recurring training, and that was an awful lot of fun.
Cathay City, what is this? It's a training facility for Cathay pilots?
Basically, out at the airport, they basically built an entire city for Cathay employees. So there's a hotel there that only flight crew on layovers can stay at. They have a pub, a grocery store, a gift shop. I mean, everything that you would expect to see in a little city or a village is there for their employees, you know, along with the training center and flight operations and the whole thing to run the airline, the maintenance facility. I mean, everything's there. And yeah, got to do a tour of that, which was really fun.
Yeah, nice.
And then one day I was out at Hong Kong Harbor and got to see the last flight of the Cathay 747. So they did a special flight. So they did a low level pass in the harbor, and that was really, really cool being able to see that. And you know, kind of sad seeing everyone retire their 747s, but it was certainly special just being at the right place at the right time on the right day to see that. So
yeah, great.
Lots of fun there.
Now you attended an air show recently also.
I did. Over this weekend I was in Huntington Beach and was fortunate enough to get a press pass for that, and saw the air show and saw the Thunderbirds perform. It was actually my very first time seeing the Thunderbirds. And I must say, I've seen a lot of photographs of the Thunderbirds, and I was never really impressed with the plane. Seeing it in person and seeing the color scheme, it is a gorgeous aircraft. I was just shocked over seeing it in person. So really happy to do that. There was a C-47 on display. The Breitling jet team was there. Breitling was the major sponsor of it. There was the Screaming Sasquatch, which was really interesting. It's a biplane that has a jet engine attached to it.
Really?
And for watching power? That perform. Yep. Yeah, and watching that perform was really amazing. So it would do a lot of the typical biplane type stuff, and then it would go vertical and they'd turn on the jet engine, and this thing just shot sky. I mean, it just went skyward. It was a rocket ship. It was just amazing to watch that, and really loud. I didn't realize that it had a jet engine on it when it first started. So I was looking around because I knew an F-15 was supposed to be there. And I was looking in the sky looking for the F-15 going, where is it? It must be here somewhere. And then I realized that the jet engine was coming from the biplane. So
this has its normal piston engine as well as this jet engine. Interesting.
Yeah, I'll try and get a photograph of it for the show notes, but it was really, really interesting. And I met with someone from the marketing department who hopefully we could get them on as a guest, because I think that would make for a really good story talking about just, you know, who even came up with the idea of putting a jet engine on a biplane. But watching it do the acrobatics was really, really neat, really special.
Now, you recorded an interview.
I did. So I was able to talk with Staff Sergeant Danny Wolfram and just talked about the Thunderbird's participation at the air show. So probably a good lead in to run that bit of tape.
Hi, this is Brian Coleman. I'm in beautiful Huntington Beach, California at the Breitling Huntington Beach Air Show. I'm joined by Staff Sergeant Danny Wolfram of the United States Air Force. Sergeant Wolfram, thank you very much for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So it's a great day for an air show today, isn't it? And not a bad venue either.
Definitely. This is awesome. We haven't been here before, so we're definitely excited to be here in Huntington Beach.
As we get started here, I just wanted to know, how did you get involved with Thunderbirds and what do you do for them?
So it's actually kind of funny. I actually have a pretty long history. I was an Air Force brat. I used to go to the Thunderbird air shows as a kid. So definitely had a really good pride for the Air Force and the Thunderbirds. I was actually born in Thunderbird Hospital. It's crazy. I enlisted the Air Force and the Thunderbirds swore me in. I'm a plan and scheduling maintenance management. I saw the job pop up. We have a kind of like a jobs.com kind of system, and it popped up and I was like, wow, that would be awesome to be a Thunderbird. So I applied for the team. You have to send a full length photo. You have to send all your evaluations, your PT scores, your physical tests. So I applied and I luckily got selected. That's how
I got. Yeah, so they want to make sure that you look good in uniform, huh? From head to toe.
I mean, we're representing the Air Force.
So what's your tour duty length with the Thunderbirds?
So for the enlisted side, we're going to be serving for 3 years, a controlled tour, and a 4-year option. With that, we'll go on to our regular duty stations. It could be just about anywhere from here. With our officers, they're actually on a 2-year, 3-year maximum tour, and they will actually be on every single TDY for those 2 years from March to November.
Okay, and the air show takes you all around the country. There are no international shows, correct?
Right now, they are stateside. We had Puerto Rico, so that's kind of in a way, but other than that, we haven't been overseas in a good while. We have heard talks of possibly soon, but as of right now, we're just staying stateside.
Okay, yeah, that'll be nice to see you do the performance around the world for sure, and I'm sure many of our international listeners would love to see you guys as well. So this is actually my first time seeing the Thunderbird since the accident that happened in June with Major Alex Turner. Is there anything different in this show post-accident versus previous?
So when the accident did happen, we actually stood down for a little bit. From there, we started up with a 5-ship show. But now Major Alex Turner is back to his number 6 spot. It's the same exact show that you would have saw at the beginning of the year.
Okay, that's great. And it's nice to see that he's able to join the team again.
He's actually going to be going to the number 5 spot next year as lead solo.
Okay, great. So there are 3 more shows this season. What will you do when the season's over? And will you be joining the team for the 2017 season when it starts back up in Daytona?
From November to March, we'll actually have our training season. So as soon as the show season's over, that's when we start going Monday to Friday, 2 goes a day, and we'll actually just continue and practice all throughout the practice season up until March when the show season comes up.
Wow, so there's no vacation time for you guys.
I mean, we do have a like training season break, but for the most part, training season is for us to improve and get as close as we can and the most safe and effective, awesome air show that we can put up.
Yeah, I know. In watching the show yesterday, there was the one maneuver where you had the two opposing planes come and they do a knife edge. And I believe there's a tad bit of visual trickery going on there. But the planes certainly get close to each other and flying at a closing rate of over 1,000 miles an hour at what? 200, 500 feet off the ocean, that's definitely some skilled flying and some talented people in the cockpit of these aircraft.
Oh, yes, definitely. They have tons and tons of experience, lots of practice. And actually, the Friday show is used kind of for a practice field for not only the location, but for them to just get used to being around this area and being able to do a most safe and effective maneuver and air show that they can.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that it's a little bit different having the center line over the ocean as opposed to land. So there must be certain challenges for them.
Yes, and I mean, every air show is different. We have different sets of markers. So, yeah, that Friday show is definitely something that they love to have just so they can get used to it and give people a better show on those Saturday and Sunday days.
Something special that I saw yesterday was an enlistment ceremony. Is that something that's normal for the Thunderbirds?
Yes, one of our main objectives is actually to recruit and retain in the Air Force. So, like I said, when I first joined the Air Force, I actually enlisted and I got sworn in through the Thunderbirds. So, kind of crazy how a full circle happens. But yes, we were able to swear in some of the local people in this community. And it's definitely one of the most awesome goals and one of the most awesome things that we get to do on a weekly basis.
So these kids had smiles on their face ear to ear. They were certainly excited about joining the Air Force, and I'm sure they're looking forward to their commitment in serving the country. Sergeant Wolfram, really appreciate your service, and thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for your support, sir. Definitely appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for that, Brian.
It was so much fun being called sir.
I know. Well, all right. The EAA Founders Innovation Prize. Max Trescott, you have some news on that?
Yes, so you may recall we had a guest on, just a few weeks ago, Ehab, who had won the first Founders Prize with his airball concept, which he's now working on developing. Anyway, I just figured we ought to call attention to this so that anybody out there who is, you know, an inventor or has a great idea on how they would like to help to solve Lhasa control problems, they ought to consider applying for the prize. So, I guess we'll put a link in the show notes, but it's also available on the EAA.org website under the news section.
Yeah, great. Martin, that might be a great project for some of your students.
We've definitely bantered it about, and that's usually one that goes to the aerospace engineering kids.
Great. All right, well, let's move on. We have a listener recording, just a brief one. This came in from Ted Corgan. He writes us to say that he was at the Red Bull Air Race in Indianapolis recently, and he made a little recording for us about that event. So here's Ted.
Hello again, geeks. This is Ted Corgan. I have another story of an exciting aviation event to share. Last Sunday, on October 2nd, a few friends and I went to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for the Red Bull Air Race there. We were somewhat familiar with air shows, but rookies to the sport of air racing. I had bought my ticket months ago, like in January, so this was the culmination of months of planning and hype. To Red Bull's credit, there were plenty of YouTube videos to show me what to expect, so I felt like I got to know the pilots a bit and enough technical details to make me conversational about the race and what the rules were. I picked Nigel Lamb as my preliminary favorite so I could cheer for somebody, and happily enough, he finished second place for the day. Once we got there, it was a perfect autumn day for such a race. It was overcast, chilly enough for a jacket, but warm enough for shorts, and calm as if we were sheltered from the absent wind. The few thousand fans who were there made the place feel alive. We were grateful for the open bleacher seating and the nearly unrestricted view they afforded. I had no idea of the enormity of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's a huge place. From my seat in the north stands, I legitimately needed my binoculars to see the details of the bleachers in the south region across the 2.5-mile-long circuit, the oval track. The view of the course itself was excellent. I could see all five of the air gates with two pylons. Those are the gates. I had assumed that the airplanes would take off from an external airstrip, but now I wasn't so sure. Around noon, both camera helicopters took to the skies in anticipation of the first heat. Then the first plane taxied to a runway in the infield. It took off quickly. Most took off in about 3 seconds and proceeded to set the first of many lap times. They were impressive and consistent across all pilots and all heats, typically between 1 minute, 3 seconds and 1 minute, 5 seconds, sometimes plus 2 or 3 seconds for penalties. The starting speeds were around 142 knots, and the fastest speeds were even higher, which seemed lightning quick as we watched the planes fly most of the course below 15 meters, or about 50 feet, above the ground. Seriously low-altitude flying by Edge 540s and a few MXSs. Perhaps best of all, the high-G vertical turn was directly in front of us. Each plane would fly level through the gate, then pull up hard and fast to a maximum of 10 Gs. The aircraft had to constrain its motion to pure pitch until it was fully vertical, at which point it could continue the barrel roll to the side and begin to set up for the next gate. An active airport was also nearby, south of the speedway, and airliners regularly flew behind the race action, sometimes passing through the low clouds, which was a delight to see, just beautiful. Phone pictures don't do the race justice, but I did get one showing a race plane in full bank away from us, an airliner in the far background, and a camera helicopter above in the middle distance, arranged such that a straight line could be drawn between them, and I will send that picture to you so it can be included in the show note, in the show notes, perhaps. Now, one of the intermission acts, the ones between the main heats, was a series of B-17 flyovers. I was not expecting those. They were a surprise. First, the Flying Fortress executed a slow banking turn over the crowd and the course. Then it made a second run with the bomb bay doors open. Now, that's something I had never seen. It was pretty powerful as I realized that that's what some bomb recipients in World War II may have seen firsthand, though of course the aircraft would have been much higher. And the third pass was even more moving. The B-17 trailed smoke from its number 2 engine. Yes, it was obviously airshow smoke and no cause for concern, but it hammered home the symbolism of the aircraft. You know, those like it that dealt with real damage, real smoke from whatever engine, and sometimes didn't make it home. As an engineer, I enjoy learning about the technical details of the air race, how the airplanes function, what the rules are, so on and so forth. But what made the event, with its course repetition and similar lap times, really worth attending was the commentators who made fans like me feel engaged with the drama of the competition and, above all, the exceptional skills of the pilots. It felt more personal to witness the strain on the pilots' faces and the ground whipping over their heads in the cockpit cams. These guys are athletes, and I would go to that race again.
Thanks, Ted, for that. Really nicely done. Okay, moving on to listener mail. We have quite a bit, but we only have time for just a few to mention on the episode. We did hear from Patrick Wiggins. And he commented to us about the topic of hypoxia that we were discussing with Christine Negroni's book. And he mentioned a program, an FAA program, called the Portable Reduced Oxygen Training Enclosure, or PROTE. Is that PROT or PROTE? I'll say PROT.
Sounds great.
Patrick says, unlike the fixed facility in Oklahoma, PROTE is, as the name implies, portable, can be brought to you. He said he first heard about the program when he read about it in the January-February 2015 issue of FAA Safety Briefing, and that's the article, Do You Know Your Canary? We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And he said that after sharing that info with his local flight school, they arranged to have one of these set up in their hangars, invited the public to try it out. Now, he said, so insidious how stealthily the effects caught up with me and my fellow participants. While not particularly pleasant, It really was an informative and valuable learning experience. All in all, I highly recommend the training. So thanks, thanks, Patrick, for that. Briefly, we received an email from our friend Jody Bromer, and she got to meet Dick Rutan and was pretty excited about that. At the time, she said 30 years ago today when she met him, I guess, they flew around the world in 9 days. Incredibly nice guy. Has even soloed a helicopter. Of course, you'll recall Jody is a helicopter pilot. She writes, says the upgrades to the Easy platform are great. Cruises at 210 knots, retractable landing gear, and 7 gallons per hour in leaned cruise. She says, closes with, never got a chance to ask about the F-105. Sorry. And she sends along a photo with the long Easy. I've always loved these airplanes. It's just the design is just so attractive to me, I think.
Yeah, they're definitely special looking.
We'll put a link in the show notes to some photos that Mark Newton took. He sort of did a little tour around portions of Australia. This is Goolwa to Bankstown to Griffith. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can find that. Also, Paul Filmer, one of the better aviation photographers around, he visited that North Korean air show we mentioned, I think, a couple of issues ago, and came back with really a nice collection of photographs. So we'll put a link to those pictures in the show notes. Have a look at that. Some really interesting aircraft.
Yeah, I didn't realize if you attended one of those shows, you could also come back. We're happy you got out of there.
I'd be a little nervous going to North Korea myself.
But, a little? Holy cow. But, yeah, I would be very nervous.
Paul takes some amazing, amazing photos. You can his website is skippyscage.com, but we'll have a link to this collection from North Korea.
Yeah, they were great pictures. But I'd go, though. So if someone...
Would you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, not me.
I would go.
You're the world traveler, Martin. Or...
Yeah, I try. Yeah.
Yeah.
They actually, in addition to the air show, one of the North Korean tour offerers or tour providers will actually do, I think it's in September every year, a aviation geek, essentially fly-in to the country where you have the opportunity to fly in a bunch of different Soviet-era airplanes and see some of the various different North Korean pieces of infrastructure as well.
Wow. Interesting. Fascinating.
So if anyone wants to, it was around my birthday this year. So if anyone's looking to give a birthday gift to an Airplane Geeks guest, I'm always happy to take one for the team and come back and report on it.
All right. Sounds great.
So how do you get there? I mean, you've been to South Korea, obviously. How do you get into North Korea to attend the air show? Do they have a bus or what do they do?
Nope. You have to go through Beijing. And Air Koryo, the Korean national or the North Korean national airline, has flights to Beijing and a couple of places in Russia as well. So you'll fly through Beijing.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Martin Rotler, the lecturer and the industry relations coordinator for the Ohio State University's Center for Aviation Studies. Martin, give us the website once more where folks can go learn more about that.
aviation.osu.edu. And thank you very much for having me on. It's been a great podcast.
All right. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/424. You can also find links on our homepage to where you can find us on social media, how to send us an email, and all that. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Brian Coleman, where do people reach you?
The best place to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. Also wanted to make a quick request. Next year, I'm going to be going to South Africa. So any of our South African listeners, if they want to give me a hand in organizing my trip and or getting together, I'm quite happy to get any help at all in pulling this trip together.
All right. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you online?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can, of course, find me on Friday mornings with that other guy, Max Flight, talking about aircraft without people in them on the UAVdigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, they can always find me at the Palo Alto Airport. So if you're out here and you want to do some flying in glass cockpit aircraft, let me know. And if you want to meet America's newest remote pilot, let's see. That, by the way, thanks, Martin, for plugging my book. So I'll tell folks that they can find that at g1000book.com. Also have a book on the IFR for folks that are flying with Garmin 430s and 530s and other modern GPSs for IFR. Same website, g1000book.com. And you can always find Max Truscott on Facebook or Twitter.
Good. And you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at the PaxX podcast I do with Mary Kirby. That's at PaxXpodcast.com. Of course, you can find most of us at the Airplane Geeks listener team on Slack. If you want to learn more about that, just visit airplanegeeks.com/team. And just once again, I'll ask if you'd be so kind as to take our quick survey. Find that at airplanegeeks.com/survey. The results have been very interesting. I've been keeping them kind of close to the vest. I haven't shared them with the guys yet, but we'll be doing that soon. And of course, we'll share the results with all of you. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely. Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.